Just one quick, we should get started. So just one very quick thing, some questions came in on cards that we didn't have the time to answer, you know, or discuss in the, you know, in the before the break. And so Richard will discuss those as part of his discussion section on Thursday. Is that right?
He will coordinate
the discussion of those questions.
Okay, thanks.
Good. So I just want to tell you what you already know, that there are going to be three talks of about 15 minutes on topics that haven't been covered yet. Well, one of the topics is me talking about faceplates, and it was covered by Bob, but we're going to talk about it anyway. So three 15-minute talks, and then there'll be general discussion. And one of the things we might talk about, if we don't run into dinner time, is different alternatives for making some of these high-end technologies available for the general people, not just only for the 1%, but for the 97%. no more jokes. So Holger is going to tell us about the general topic of CS corrector. Henning, I'm not sure what he's going to tell. And I'm going to talk about faceplates. And these are all things that are not mainstream now. They might become mainstream. In a way, they're progress reports and, or challenges of things to be solved. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Bob. So I have it here, CS correction in biology with a question mark, and but I try to show you that there is something that you may gain from CS correction during my talk. It's a very well-proven technology for material science, so there's no doubt that CS correction is very good in material science applications. So there's more than 300 CS-corrected microscopes now distributed over the world, and they are heavily being used by material scientists. But in biology, the situation is slightly different because we work in different modes. So in material science, we work very close to focus always. And in biology, as we all know, we don't work very close to focus, and that makes it more complicated. So the idea how to correct for spherical aberration is actually is very old, and it goes back to Otto Scherzer, and he came up with this Scherzer theorem that you if you have spherical and chromatic aberration, which you always have, if you have round lenses, that you cannot correct them by any system where you have additional round lenses, so it will always just add up to your to the problem. So what you need is hexapole lenses to correct for CS, and this is currently being used in the correctors that we have in our microscope, in our Titan Cryos. This is a corrector with two hexapole lenses. There's now next generation design where you can have three hexapole lenses to do even more things. So, but this is the current design that has been developed by Max Heider and Harald Rose, actually, and they were working on that system for quite some time. So the first corrector prototype goes back to 1970. So this is the first corrector they have built. It was working, but it was not improving things. So they invested a lot over the last decades in improving the technology, and only for the last decade this is a commercially available system and is being used heavily nowadays. So this is how it looks in our microscope. This is, it actually, the whole microscope hangs on the CS corrector. So this is the CS corrector. So it's mounted on the CS corrector. That's also one reason why you can't retrofit it in any of the Titans you may have all over the world. FEI doesn't do that. So you either buy it straight away, or you can't retrofit a Titan with a CS corrector. Everything the corrector does is based on measuring Zemlin tableaus. And this goes back to Fritz Zemlin's paper published in Ultramicroscopy in 1978. And it's just recording images, calculating power spectra under different beam tilt conditions, everything we do to correct for coma and other aberrations. So you have seen that this morning already. In the corrector, this is done in a more extensive way. So you correct for you record many of those beam tilt images, and you can have the more you have, and the further out you can tilt, the better you can do the correction of your microscope. So that's the idea. And you see what happens in a CS corrected microscope is slightly different to what you have in a non corrected microscope, namely that all those power spectra of all those images at different tilts, they're actually rotationally symmetric. So you don't have any distortions in those images. So this is one difference. This is how the software looks like. So it records all these beam tilt images. And then you have these phase plate that is being calculated from all the data that you can extract from those power spectra. And that shows you here with the purple, with this magenta ring, this is the pi over 4 resolution limit. So when your phase errors reach pi over 4, it shows you that you're better than that at a certain scattering angle that is shown. I'm not sure, I can't see it. Yeah, it's here. This is telling you 15 millirad. And then it shows you here that this is a certain aberration that is still limiting you, and then you can go on and correct for the different levels of aberration using the software that is implemented in the system. But it always goes back on and calculates and records new sending tableaus and makes use of those. So it heavily relies on this. And that is also a very good measure to tune the microscope. So you will see it brings down coma. Coma is actually called B2 here. So you can optimize the coma down to a few nanometers with a corrector. If you use just a normal FEI microscope and you would rely on the normal software that is on a microscope, you would never be even close to that value. So if we can try that, we can use the FEI corrector, the FEI software, and then measure the coma that you have later on in the corrector software, and you will never get better than a few hundred nanometer coma. It's just impossible to do that. So this is one advantage of the corrector already, that you can just do better alignments. But this doesn't necessarily need a corrector. It would need a better system in order to constantly work with Semlin tableaus and do the same kind of evaluation that you do here in the software. So if you look at what happens if you go further to focus, and this is a bit over-exaggerated, I assumed a very high energy spread, but this is what you have if you work at CS0 and at CS3 millimeter. You see the situation at CS0 is actually worse if you have to defocus, because you have more zero crossings at the same nominal defocus, and you should also have a stronger decay in your information, because everything you do is what happens in a CS-corrected microscope. While you go with CS to zero, the chromatic aberration goes up. And the chromatic aberration is partially responsible for the envelope function of the signal. So looking at that, and it's just at the theoretical CDF curve, you would not think that the CS-corrector is of any use for biology. And but if you do the measurements and if you just compare what happens if you look, for example, at blood and iridium grids with a CS corrector on, that's the black curve here, then you see that you have tone rings very well defined. This is the 2 angstrom region here. Then you see that you get the tone rings well defined way beyond 2 angstrom. And if we just switch off the hexapole lenses of the corrector, which still gives you a one-to-one image, so there's no change in magnification and nothing. If you do that, then you see that there's much less tone rings that you can see if you turn off the hexapoles. And that is not dependent on the level of coma that is present there, because if you just introduce different amounts of coma here, then you see it's actually not much different, and you see at very high resolution. The blue and the red is just different coma values for the corrected, for the hexapole off situation where you have a CS of 3, and the black one is the CS 0 situation, and you see that you can really get tone rings out to very far. solution. So, and then also if you look at the information limit, this is what you get with the Titan CS-corrected microscope. So it's very clear that we can get one angstrom and sometimes even beyond one angstrom information limit. While a Titan without CS corrector is slightly worse in the resolution limit. So it's not bad. I mean, it's certainly a very good microscope, but it is slightly worse. So if we turn off the CS corrector by switching off the hexapod, our information limit is varying between 1.2 and 1.4 angstrom. If you have a Titan without CS corrector, it's usually slightly better than what we get by just switching off the hexapod lenses. But it's in the same ballgame here. But at 80 kilovolt, the situation is slightly different, because there you have, if you just turn off the CS corrector, or if you have a Titan without the CS corrector, you are in the 3 angstrom and above region in terms of the information limit, while with the CS corrected Titan, you can still get better than 2 angstrom resolution. And this is not at all clear. It shouldn't necessarily be like that, because the information limit should also be varied by CC. It's dependent on the chromatic aberration, and the chromatic aberration is higher in a CS-corrected microscope, so it's not necessarily clear that this is the case for what we have here, that we really get a higher information limit for a CS-corrected microscope. It's not clear to me, at least, why that is the case. Another thing is, as I said, the microscope can be used, if you have a CS corrector, to align it almost perfectly well, because we have full control over all the levels of aberrations that we have, not only second, but up to fifth order aberrations. This is controllable by the CS corrector, and that means we can correct for very high aberrations. And if you look at the beam tilt here, this is, obviously we have heard about it, this is COMA, it's very strongly resolution limiting at the higher resolution, so beyond 5 angstrom, this is really killing you. And so this depends on the spatial frequency to the power of 3. So the higher you want to get in resolution, the more serious it becomes. It also is dependent on the wavelength on the CS. But if you take this formula and you just think if you put CS to 0, you won't have any coma, this is also not true, because then this formula is only valid for uncorrected microscopes. If you have a corrected microscope, then this is being replaced by higher order aberrations. So what we can do is we can look at what kind of accuracy in alignment do we get for a CS-corrected microscope. And that is really different compared to what you can get for a non-corrected microscope. So this is a quite complicated plot that I have to go through that very quickly, because I don't have a lot of time to talk. So we measure with the CS corrector where the resolution limit in a way where we hit the pi over 4 phase errors. So we look in the phase aberration plot where we hit the pi over 4 resolution limit. And that is, if you have a CS corrected microscope, we can usually correct that to about 14 millirad scattering angle. And that is that corresponds to a maximum resolution that you can get in terms of these pi over 4 phase errors to about 2 angstrom in the best case. We can correct it sometimes up to 15 or 16 millirad, so we are better than between 1.5 and 2 angstrom in terms of these phase errors. And if you have no corrector, if you have correct the Titan Grios just with using coma-free alignment and the tools you have in the system, you can't actually do this correction better than to 3 angstrom. And if you just rely on the rotation center alignment only, then your phase error hits you already at 7 angstrom resolution. So this is why you have to do the coma correction if you want to go to higher resolution. Another thing is, if you want to use spot scan, you can tune the corrector in a way that you, when you do spot scanning over a hole, that you can compensate. You can tune the corrector that it compensates for these beam tilt induced coma, so we can keep, as you can see here, we can keep the image shift and beam shift induced coma very, very small, so that we can always, whether we are in the center of the hole or at the edge of a hole or even beyond, we can keep that at a level where coma never hits us at the level of 3 angstrom resolution, so we are always doing better. But the yellow curve is what you always get if you have an uncorrected microscope, so there's no way to improve that. And then what you can also calculate, because the high tension is very important, so what you can get is with the CS correlated microscope, in terms of these pi over 4 limitations here, you can get a resolution limit of 1.8 angstrom for a CS corrected microscope at 300 kilovolt, but still at 3 angstrom at 80 kilovolt. And you can get the 3 angstrom without a CS corrector at 300 kilovolt. So actually, a CS corrected microscope, in terms of the optical behavior and the alignment quality you can have, is pretty much comparable to a 80 kilovolt corrected microscope, is pretty much comparable to a non-corrected 300 kilovolt microscope. And that means, that shows you here the situation. So this is graphene at 80 kilovolt in a non-corrected microscope, in a Titan cryos without CS.
No.
Okay. and this is with, so you get here you see the high resolution spots at very clearly, while you don't see it here at 80 kilovolt. So at 80 kilovolt.
So why do you need to use the F10 mode in this tube?
Yeah, this was a Titan cryos in at FEI, so it was not ours, so we don't have that. Just maybe if you give me one or two more minutes, I can show you quick examples of how. So especially at 80 kilovolt, the microscope should be very good. So at 80 kilovolt, you get better contrast, and this is what I would like to show you very quickly. So this is a 500 kilodalton complex. It's actually P97. So this is how it looks like if you have a 1 point at 80 kilovolt using CS0. It's on carbon film. This is the contrast you get at about 2 micron defocus. This is at 0.7 defocus, and this is smaller than 0.1. So you can see that it's still clearly visible, even if you're working very close to focus. This is another example, because we have crystallized this complex. This is this fixed sample I have told you before. This is at a defocus of only 0.5 micrometer. At CS0, and you can clearly see the structures, and you can also see very clear details in the structure. We can analyze those molecules, they classify, and you can make use of those images. This is another example. This is only a 125 kilodalton complex at 1 micrometer defocus at 80 kV at CS0, and all this is on carbon film, so I think this can even still be further improved if you work in holes. But they are very clearly visible, and you can work with that. So we can get some contrast enhancement, but what I just wanted to show you here, this is if you have the CS corrector on, and this is low-dose images of ribosomes, and just individual ribosomes cut out. I think it's 36 ribosomal, no, 212 ribosomal images, just individual ribosomes cut out, have those that have the same defocus, and we get tone rings out to 2.4 angstrom on an hour Falcon camera with this system. And so what I think is, at 80 kilovolt, we have a very powerful system. So for smaller molecules, you should be able to get very high resolution and look at small molecules. And this is something you would not be able to do without a CS corrector, so it may be very useful for that. A disadvantage is that it's, of course, not cheap, but there is no other reason why you should not have a CS corrector. So in all aspects, it helps you in your daily work, but of course, it's a very expensive piece of equipment. And if you have the choice between a new detector and a CS corrector, you should always go for the detector, obviously. So that gives you a bigger gain. So then I would like to thank the people who are involved in that. So this is Uwe Lücken and Martin Bischoff from FEI, and Max Heider and Peter Hartl from TEOS in Heidelberg. Thank you.
We're running a little over time, but we can have a couple of questions. And other ones, write down your questions and bring them in.
I mean, this is now not so different. At 80 kilovolt, what I've shown you now, this is pretty much how it behaves. The contrast is good. It's only it's also good at in a non-corrected microscope. But you can never align a non-corrected microscope to the same level. That's pretty clear.
It's not expected that the CS would make a difference.
That the CS would make slightly more contrast. This is not what you would expect. And we are now collaborating with Dirk van Dijk in Antwerp. And we have an idea that maybe thermal diffuse scattering may play a role, and we do simulations on that.
Well, it's not just a slight effect. It really goes, it extends the rings out.
Yeah, but this is, as I said, it's something that we still need to understand, and we are working on that, but it's not so easy. So it's not explainable by the weak phase theory, so you need to extend that. And maybe the thermal diffuse scattering may help us, because this is not part of the...
I'm going to arbitrarily take one more question. There are some other hands, but please.
So the CS, I don't know a lot about this, but from what I understand, is this is something that's introduced from the lens in the microscope. Is that correct?
Yes.
So why can't it be improved at the level of the lens itself?
On the lens itself, to get a lens without a spherical aberration, because you have a certain pole piece gap, and we need space for manipulating our grids, and that already creates the spherical aberration. So the material scientists, they have smaller pole piece gaps. Then you can reduce it to 1 millimeter or so in another lens, but you can't do that for our microscopes. Then you can't tilt your sample anymore. So, sorry.
Okay, so the next talk is
the microphone.
Behling Stauber.
Okay, thanks. So I want to tell you about spot scan or the comparison between TEM and STEM. I will tell you what that is. So this is not a progress report, because I have not worked on this in the last 4 years, and you will see why this is. So this is what session was asked to do, and I chose this then versus conventional TEM as a topic. In my group, we work on membrane proteins, and we do this with 2D crystallization. We look at membrane proteins, add lipids, and try to form these 2D crystals. And we want to look at the structure of these then membrane proteins in lipids with electron crystallography. Yeah? And we do this by going to the electron microscope with frozen hydrated samples and take pictures. And then we can calculate the Fourier transforms of these pictures, and the pictures show us diffraction spots out of some resolution. This is a non-tilted crystal. And then with the MRC software that Richard Henderson wrote, we process these pictures. We have a front end for that, which is called 2DX, and then get 2D projection maps. This is an IQ plot of such a picture showing isotropic resolution. And then we want the 3D structure, and for that, we tilt the samples and take pictures of the tilted crystals and in Fourier space make a 3D reconstruction. So now for us, the challenge is to record high-resolution pictures of highly tilted samples. And high resolution means 2 angstroms if possible. Yeah? And we have nice microscopes. And then in many cases, the electron microscope produces images, and the Fourier transformation of these images looks, yes, now in the laser diffractometer, like this. These spots prove that this was a highly ordered crystal, was a great grid, but there's only resolution in one direction, which is the tilt axis. And orthogonally to the tilt axis, there's nothing. And that is beam-induced resolution loss on tilted samples. This is highly frustrating for if you spend months to purify your sample, crystallize it, go to the microscope, you have to prove that this worked, but then this beam-induced resolution loss ruins everything. One way to avoid this is electron diffraction, but for that you need really large crystals and very flat preparations. Tom Waltz is good in making this for Joshi in Japan, but if you have smaller crystals, you can't do diffraction, and then all you have is this, and that's useless. So sometimes it works, but this is the reason why most electron crystallography structures of membrane proteins, here are some good structures from the literature, they have a better resolution in the horizontal direction than in the vertical direction. In most cases, there's more than a factor of 2 in difference. Yeah? The reasons for this anisotropy is three things. First, crystals sometimes are not flat. You can try to improve that, but the alternative is a single particle processing, and we are working on that. Another reason is this missing cone problem, that we can record images of tilted samples up to 60 degrees, but not 90 degrees. We have developed a software approach to reconstruct data in this missing cone, which I can show here. So this is the bacteriorhodopsin structure. I think David de Rossier showed this 2 days ago from a paper from 97 from Fujiyoshi. Bacteriorhodopsin here near the shift base has this quality in their publication from 97. They used the same data and applied Finab-Gerchberg-Saxton algorithm, which David Elgott worked on also in the 70s with Bob Stroud, to improve this data set. This is then the initial reconstruction made from this very same data set from 97, and I overlaid an X-ray model just to guide the eye, but we didn't use that for processing. And then when you run this iterative algorithm, you reconstruct data in the missing cone and also improve the structure. And we now see these side chains that were before invisible. So I don't think this is a charging issue. It was just mostly missing cone. Details are described here. So this is the missing cone problem, but the biggest problem is this beam-induced resolution loss. Yeah? And one approach to deal with this is called spot scan. So what happens is either charging, that when you take a picture of the non-tilted sample, the sample charges up during image recording, and that's not a problem if the sample is non-tilted, but if it's tilted, then the charging may deflect the electron beam. The other application or explanation that I like more is that it's a physical movement due to differential expansion coefficients of ice and carbon film. Bob Glaser came up with this idea, I think. And this is very visible from the side, and then you have resolution loss. And one way to approach this then is spot scanning, where you reduce the beam to a small diameter and have this step over the crystal. And then the problem is restricted to a small diameter of 100 nanometers or so, and then that's much better to handle. In collaboration with Hans Tietz and TVIPS, with their CMOS camera that is covered with a scintillator, it's a very affordable CMOS camera, we have now implemented a spot scan routine where we have one focusing position and then spot scanning spots. And now every spot scan spot is recorded on one CMOS frame. It's a 4K by 4K CMOS frame. We bin it down to 2K by 2K or maybe 1K by 1K. Then the MTL for DQE is excellent at the binned resolution. And then we have a patch montage software that transforms all these into one big image. And we are working on CTF correcting every single frame, potentially also correcting beam tilt, effects of beam tilt during that, to get then the off-axis coma under control, which we will run into here. There is an alternative approach for tilted samples where we have, for every row of spots along the tilt axis, one focus position, so that these should all be on the same focus, and you don't have a defocus gradient over your picture. So this should be a low-budget or cheap, poor man's way to go to digital recording with a very good MTF or DQE without a direct electron detector. Direct electron detector would be better, of course. So the alternative is now STEM. In STEM, you take your TEM, and instead of recording pictures here, you will put a bright field and dark field detector here and count how many electrons fly straight through your sample or are deflected. And you also focus your beam onto a spot, the probe, and then scan the sample with this probe. This has various applications also in biology. At high dose in material sciences, you can record EEL spectra or X-ray spectra of your location and can characterize which atoms you have in your sample. In biology, you can do tomography, STEM tomography. You may not know with a 3 micrometer thick sample where your electrons come out to the bottom, and so imaging is very difficult. But at least you know where the electrons went in, which is where you focused your beam and then started scanning. And so with very thick samples, 3 micrometers or so, with 300 kilovolts, you may still have a chance to see something, at least for the upper half of your sample. There are some applications where people did a tomography of the grid, first the upper half with STEM tomography, and then took the grid out, put it back in upside down, and took a second tomogram, the tilt series, from the other side, and then put both together into one 3D reconstruction. Another application is mass measurements using only the dark field detector here, the high angle and dark field detector. The signal here is proportional to the atomic mass of the sample squared. It's called Z-square contrast. So uranyl acetate gives a huge contrast compared to carbon, or gold on carbon is very visible. Usually in TEM, the contrast is proportional to the atomic mass linearly. In dark field STEM, it's squared. STEM can go to very high resolution. In UC Davis, where I was until 2009, I collaborated with Nigel Browning, and they work in material sciences with STEM. And I think the record is now at 0.5 angstrom resolution. Typically, a TEM that can also do STEM reaches higher resolution in STEM mode than in TEM mode. So it's a method for very high resolution in material sciences. In biology, it's usually useless. The bright field detector doesn't show you anything. This is TMV in ice. The dark field detector shows you some shadow. But it's also, the contrast is lousy because this is both only amplitude contrast. So usually, conventional STEM is absolutely useless for us. We tried this nevertheless because of this beam-induced resolution loss on tilted samples. We tilted the sample, and we ran into lots of problems with the cryo sample that we melted our sample. The dose was too high. We had contamination issues. But at least we never had any issue with beam-induced resolution loss on tilt. Yeah, so in my opinion, if you tilt the sample or not, that doesn't matter at all if you're in STEM mode. So this was my motivation to keep going on this. We tried to go to low dose by just scanning very fast. You reach a wall at 1 microsecond per pixel. From then on, you have some smears because your detectors aren't fast enough usually. So you need to, but still, you can go to very high resolution. This is a material sciences sample, and we reach a few angstrom, 2 angstrom resolution or so at 1 electron per square angstrom. So it is possible to align this CS-corrected stem, in this case, at very low dose. But what you really need is a beam dimmer. This is one proposition we can discuss. So how about we ask the manufacturers to build a beam dimmer that dims the beam in the time domain by switching it on and off with a very fast beam blanker in the nanosecond regime. And I think this should be possible by combining one beam blanker for on and a second beam blanker for off. So you can't have one beam blanker going on-off for 10 nanoseconds, but you can have one on within a nanosecond, and the second one switches off 10 nanoseconds later. That should be possible. And then you would have the big volume button, like on your stereo, and just dim the beam, and you don't have to touch anything else, not the extraction voltage, not the gun lens, not the condenser illumination conditions or so. And with this, you could go to high dose, focus your stem, and then to low dose to record your pictures. 3 more minutes, okay. So then the other problem is how to go to phase contrast. And usually when you have your bright field detector in your plane here, your oncogram, you don't get any phase contrast signal. But if you include a CS corrector, then your Ronchigram here in this central plane shows a very broad spot. And that gives you access to phase contrast. So now I have to see how I can skip all kinds of things. In Davis, we tried to simulate what kind of signal you would see on your bright field detector under different defocusing conditions and different condenser aberrations in your spherical aberration corrector here. And we came up with settings of a little bit of defocus and a little bit of CS, where we should have a good phase contrast signal on our bright field detector. And that's not a new idea. The literature is old on that, from 1995, Harald Rohs, but this was without considering aberration correction. And Max Heider also tried to build a detector that could harvest some signal like that, but also before he invented or built the first phase aberration corrector. And in 2007, together with Gattahan, we set out and Gill to build a machine that would do this, a little bit of CS, a little bit of defocus, to produce a Ronchigram with a decent phase contrast contribution here. And we wanted to harvest that signal with a multi-channel detector. This was funded by the Keck Foundation. And we had plans for 8,000 by 8,000 pixels on this sample, collecting the phase contrast signal here, a nanosecond beam chopper, and we started building this. But then I got this possibility to go to Europe, to Switzerland, and when I left California, the Keck Foundation wanted their money back, and then everything stopped. The machine is still there, but now it's used by the material scientists in Basel. And in Davis. And in Basel, I don't have a stem. Yeah, so I started working on upgrading one of the machines in with a stem mode, but with a CS corrector, that's not possible with FEI, in cryo at least. FEI does not support CS corrected cryo stem. And one could now use also a direct electron detector here. One more idea I want to voice here, because Bob Glaser is going to speak about phase plates. This is a normal stem. What about we align the top mode of the microscope in stem mode and scan a very small beam of one angstrom probe size over the sample and have the lower part of the column in TEM alignment so that we image, or if you first descan the scanning beam, and then image this point onto the bright field detector, then you would not see anything. Then you would have all electrons scattered or non-scattered onto this bright field detector, and your image would be flat white. But then, if you put here a faceplate, tulip or electrostatic or so, then you should see a very strong phase contrast signal. And here it could be a centimeter in size, not a micrometer. You know, so you don't need to work with micrometer small things. And then the charging issue is non-existent, because if you are 100 times bigger, then your charging or dose rate is 10,000 times lower. So you shouldn't have any charging or heating needs here. You have a lot of space. The resolution is defined by the probe size, angstroms. You should have full contrast down here, faceplate contrast. So this is for discussion. Would this work? It's just an idea. And that's what I just told you. Now I try to upgrade our Titan with the stem mode and collected some money, and I think I have a good idea where I put this money that I collected now to, which is a camera, right, a filming camera. Which is probably a much better approach for these beam-induced resolution loss. So this is 4-year-old, this topic, and I guess from my point it may stay there. So that's my contribution. Yeah. You need free lens control, right, to do this. You need to scan and descan. You need good teamwork with FEI or Joule or Hitachi, and then free lens control and program this yourself. Yeah? You need a descanning system that is proportional to the scanning, a bright field detector, fast electronics. This should be a photomultiplier or some CMOS thing or so, and then your faceplate. Faceplate can go in the beam stop, right, or selected area aperture holder. But you need to be in the back focal plane of the lens.
So it cannot be done without the FEI?
It can be done, yeah, sure. You just need a screwdriver. I mean, you can't do it. you can't do it on a VG. You need a TEM scan, a S-TEM combined instrument. A VG instrument has nothing behind the sample. There's no lenses anymore. For this, you would need lenses down here.
I'm a little too slow to follow this idea. In the plane where you would put the phase plate, do I see a normal diffraction pattern?
Yes. You need to be in a back focal plane.
And that diffraction pattern, the unscattered beam is a very large diameter spot because you have such a convergent illumination to make a small spot on the specimen.
Yeah, the further down you are, the larger it should be. Yeah. So I would go after the last projector lens.
Yeah. So, and I want the phase shift, the scattered electrons relative to the unscattered. Mm-hmm. But the unscattered is a big, large spot. So my phase plate cannot intrude on that spot. It has to stay out here. And then I will have a very the cutoff frequency for phase contrast will not be most spatial.
So I thought about your electrostatic thing, this tube, which then can be a thin ring of a millimeter diameter.
I'm still too slow to understand it. So we could discuss it offline, I think, because we're, I guess, over time. Who would like to be the chair to keep me?
I can do that. Revenge.
whose Mac is this here? And somebody has to help me. Which cable do I hook up?
Let's start here with this one.
This one?
Here's the thing.
Yeah, okay.
And then it's this right here.
And I hope the hot swap works.
That's correct.
Yeah. I can always give a chalk dot.
No, it's on, okay. So this battery is almost empty. Holger, do you still have the laser somewhere? Yeah, but
I've got one.
Okay, but whatever, yeah.
Yep. The phase contrast aperture that I used for a couple of slides I'm going to show you is not a phase plate. It doesn't apply a phase shift. It blocks some of the electrons, the opaque half circle supported by a beam, and gives a single sideband contrast image at low spatial frequency and then a double sideband at high spatial frequency. And the intended result one of these has a laser. The result is you get a contrast transfer function that's a constant, 0.5, instead of this usual contrast transfer function at low spatial frequency. And then you switch to Schertzer contrast transfer function at higher spatial frequency. And I won't explain more. There is a poster just outside the door, and anybody who is curious enough, we can talk about it after the break. This is a streptavidin monolayer crystal imaged with the aperture and with the aperture retracted. It's exactly the same area and shows that a cryo-EM sample imaged at Schertzer defocus, there's no visible contrast. But with the aperture in, there's a very high contrast. And a couple of weeks ago, we were able to start recording images with the phase contrast aperture using a K2 camera. And this is several images that were merged together with the wonderful software called 2DX. And so this is various samples were tilted up to 15 degrees by accident, you know, not by tilting the stage, but they all were tilted there. So we had to merge them and extract the HK0 reflections. And the resolution goes to, with very good IQ values, to 4 angstroms, 3.5 angstroms, something like that. The aperture is compatible with high resolution to address an issue that was brought up earlier at this meeting. This compares the images. So the down below is the image formed with the structure factors that you saw in the previous slide. 300 kV taken with the K2 camera with counting and fractionation, of course, using the in-focus contrast. So we never corrected any contrast transfer function using the tulip aperture, and this is 3 angstrom map. Maybe some of the higher resolution stuff is still not very good. And this is in the literature. Agustin Avila-Sakar and Watu took an image on a 400 kV microscope with film and pretty close to focus, half micrometer or so, and the image phases were merged together with diffraction amplitudes in their case to give a 3 angstrom resolution map. For whatever reason, I kind of like the bottom one.
Why?
Just emotional, or I don't have to say why I like something. I like it. But,
I don't like it.
All right. That is the best remark so far. Okay, here is a microtubule doublet sample from Puyan Anjai and Ken Downing. Here the is a blow-up near the center. You see the edge of the tulip aperture that intentionally has a little notch. And the aperture wasn't correctly aligned, but I want to pretend that I did this on purpose. So you know, when you trip over a wire and fall on the floor, you quickly get up and say, ta-da! So this serves very good didactic purposes here in that it shows that if you don't have it all the way in, you don't have any resolution at those spatial frequencies. But you have a lot of, you don't have any contrast, but you have a lot of contrast behind the aperture, so to speak. And this is another image of an area with streptavidin monolayer crystal. There's a big crystal here on one side, another big crystal on the other side, and a little gap where there is no crystal. Presumably, the crystals grew and they came together and they occluded and no other molecules could come in on the side. There's still a few crystal molecules of streptavidin that haven't joined the crystal, and there is an amorphous, monolayer amorphous array of frustrated molecules that got together with each other, but they weren't on the crystal, and now they are ambivalent. They don't know which way to go because they're all in a low energy state. But the beautiful thing is that, yes, you can easily spot in an in-focus image single molecules that are 55 kV. And this sort of capability should increase the coverage of the proteome that's possible by a really large factor that's been said already at this meeting. The results obtained are similar to the best obtained with a carbon film Zernike phase plate, and I'm a co-author on some of that work, but it's due to Radostin Danev. And there are very, very similar problems with the tulip phase plate as with the carbon film phase plate. So, they are unreliable to manufacture, they have a short and unpredictable lifetime when you actually start with a good one. And I didn't stress it before, but it is put on the slide, and it's talked about in the poster that the tulips that we make are first cut out of a metal foil with a focused ion beam to give it the right shape and size and so forth. And then we evaporate carbon on the surface of the metal in order to overcome the patch fields that are inherent, the patchy electrostatic fields that are inherent in even the most pristine of any metal clean due to differences in work function of different crystal domains. So we are taking an easy way out to cover it all up, cover it all over with evaporated carbon that has a single value of work function. But now we are stuck with the same problem as the thin film phase plate, that the carbon ages and mysteriously kind of goes bad. So, I really quickly go through and say that the increased signal to noise, so the contrast that you can get is about 3%. Per nanometer. Sample is 10 nanometers or 20 nanometers thick, it's 6%, etc. I just want to point out that, refer you to a paper by Richard Hall and myself in Biophysical Journal. The increased signal to noise should improve particle alignment. That was mentioned. I don't know if Richard did it or somebody said it improves. Increased signal to noise at low spatial frequency should improve the particle alignment and improve the assignment of particles to structurally distinct conformations or compositions. It's all documented, but it's all simulations. And in a separate paper, Richard Hall and I estimate that features as small as 2 nanometers should be sort of the detectable limit in cryo-EM tomography using full phase contrast. Unpublished piece of work by Radostin Donev and myself is a protein called dissimulatory sulfite reductase. It's a 200 kD protein made up of 100 kD monomers. And this is a tomogram that Rado got, and you can see the individual 100 kV monomers. So it, it's a favorable situation. It's a thin sample and so forth, but with a fib, you can make the sample nice and thick and so forth. So there's plenty of motivation to carry on and overcome the charging problems and to use in-focus phase contrast. I think you don't mean quality, so other than you have to do a CTF correction. Is that what you mean? The image wave function, not the image intensity, the image wave function that you get when you form an image with this aperture is the one that you would get without the aperture convoluted with the Fourier transform of that aperture. And this is a Heaviside step function, and it has in it, in its Fourier transform, a 1 over x function, and so you get an optical shadowing effect. That's very easy to undo. Calculate the Fourier transform, multiply one half of the Fourier space with I and the other with minus I, and it undoes it. If you have an appreciable gamma of S due to defocus and spherical aberration, and in the double sideband region, it has the familiar effect. And with Schertzer defocus, you don't have to correct anything. But behind the paddle, the gamma of S shows up as a phase error, not as an amplitude error. And at Schertzer defocus, that phase error is 30 degrees. You can add a parabola, a parabolic phase error of 30 degrees, and undo that if you wish, but it's hardly worth the effort, because a phase error of 30 degrees doesn't cause much disturbance. So, yeah.
Sean has a question.
Because you're stopping the electron beam, you have this nice thick metal support, can't you just work your way through the periodic table and find a coating that doesn't age like carbon?
It doesn't taste like carbon, yes.
Age, yeah.
Age like
too close to dinner.
I think the generation before me had a saying that if wishes were horses, somebody would be kings or something like that. Yeah. So if I could go to a periodic table and flip through and find one that said it won't change, won't age like carbon, that would be a good suggestion. But I need, Lily Tomlin said, all my life I wanted to be something. Now I realize I had to be more specific. So could you please be more specific?
Well, you need amorphous coating. Non-crystalline amorphous coating.
So
it can be particularly robust.
Yeah, in a semi-serious way, a suggestion made a long time ago by somebody is that we should use a liquid metal. So it'd be amorphous and a uniform work function. It'd be self-healing if you damaged it from knock-on damage and so forth. So now I'm going to facetiously say, I immediately went to my EH&S department and said, may I please coat my aperture with mercury?
Yeah. And well,
so, I mean, it's a pretty good idea. Yeah.
So what about flashing it, like a cold fact tip?
Flashing it?
Yeah, so like a cold fact tip, that you just connect here a cable and then put it to a few thousand volts and spark it free?
So flashing it normally means heating it in a flash.
Cold fact tip, I think you put it to some voltage and then blast it free. Yeah,
yeah, so what is that called? Is that also called flashing? I don't know.
Not
the kind of flashing
I'm like. Can we eat the
carbon? Well, that's
just degrading rapidly.
That's something that you could arrange to do. But what is the hypothesis behind
that? It's carbon contamination that you blast off when you
Yeah. So I didn't say as much as is out in the poster, but this is operated at a temperature of 400 degrees C. Above 200 degrees C, you no longer have any of the familiar carbon contamination forming. But what does happen, the higher in temperature you get, the charging that you see when you intentionally touch the edge of the device, then you develop a little bubble of electrostatic charge, that actually anneals and repairs. So carbon, when it's heated, is a little bit kind of a liquid. So heating at the very high temperature for a short time, I've had some enthusiasm for, but and the idea of applying electrostatic pulse to it, high voltage pulse, may be a good idea, but I don't know the reason why that's so, or can't imagine a reason why that's so. Yeah. Who is in charge at this point?
I'm hoping that you are, Bob.
We have another half hour, don't we?
Yeah.
Yes.
This is
and,
how do we pay for all this?
Yeah. But let me ask the organizers of the workshop, do they want to have that time spent discussing questions that have come in on the postcards, or do they want us to stick to the program? Oh, I'm doing the wrong thing. Talk about what are the alternatives. So there are some people whose home departments, like UCLA, said you want 5 Krios, you can have 10. There are some people like HHMI that have Krios available on a mail-in basis, et cetera. Most of us cannot picture that we can go to a wealthy benefactor or to the federal government or anything and get the amount of money to set up a laboratory, set up a microscope of the kind already available and what they're going to become in the future, only for our own individual laboratory. And so there's a lot of people who, the science would benefit greatly from providing access in general to high-end instrumentation. Of course, in the X-ray crystallography field, that resulted in synchrotron beam lines and enormously productive and so forth. But there are so many things that are different about X-ray crystallography and electron microscopy and the beam line model. It's very well impedance matched to the requirements of the X-ray crystallography, but very, very bad impedance matched to the requirements for cryo-EM. And so the problem is the cost to purchase and maintain high-end equipment is greater and greater, and fewer PIs can have access to that at their own institution. So the question, are there financially sustainable models in terms of purchase cost and maintenance to meet the needs of PIs at institutions that cannot provide. And to start that discussion, but we want to have others. One alternative that I know about is an HHMI-like, leading or genuinely farm model, FedEx samples to, in this case, an NIH or NSF-funded central facility. It might be in Montana or, you know, who knows where it is. It doesn't have to be any place. You just FedEx it. And then the cost above and beyond the central facility is to have an emulator of some kind at your home institution that you know, looks and feels like an electron microscope, and you can run them, run it remotely, or to, or you can at least observe it and monitor the and such a facility could be staffed to operate 24/7 like a synchrotron beamline, if and when the demand rises to the level that it has to be 24/7, and then if you need two of them, that would be a modest cost to get two of them, and so forth. So that's one model, and another model. That David is always about a month or 2 months ahead of me in terms of ideas, and he mentioned the idea of a we should really start thinking about the fact that that we could have a new generation of entry level microscope that would be very, very high performance, so affordable microscope, because we can give up a whole lot of features of the current microscopes that we don't have any need for at all. So it could operate at a single voltage, maybe 300 kV, 250 kV, 275 kV, if the microscope manufacturers need an excuse to discount, you know, this is not a 300. 295? It can even have a simple cryo holder, no energy filter. No. It needs to have a high-end silicon pixel camera. Faceplates may need to be an option, but we shouldn't decide that today because they're not here. They're not ready. But okay. So any other discussions? Do you want to monitor it? Good.
I can just have the microphone around.
I think in a way, I mean, all these models already exist. Like, for example, the center right here and the one in Houston is pretty much operate like in the Geneva farm, but I don't think we speak loud enough to get the community to know. You know, basically in here and in Houston, I mean, there are a lot of users come to use it either by Federal Express, the samples, because now there are increasing numbers of lab can have a 200 kilo microscope in the lab. They can actually refine this specimen preparation and send the ice embedded specimen. I mean, I think it's in operation. I mean, the only thing is lacking, I think, like here in Houston, we don't have a state-of-art instrument. Right, Bridget?
We don't have
state-of-art instrument. We don't have a Creos.
No.
Yeah, we are poor, see.
Very poor.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the infrastructure NIH already set up that can do it this way, but NIH doesn't have any money to upgrade those facilities. Now, in Hong's facility, they have money to buy the instrument, but then the way to challenge to Hong and others is how he can replace us, either Bridget or me, or get another P41 grant to sustain that. I mean, all these options exist. I think like in UK, Richard may know more, I think the Diamond Laboratory has been approved, is that right? To get one of these high-end instruments right next to the beamline. I mean, that to me is an extremely good business model in the DOE laboratory, for example, because they are used to do this. They have all the housing facility when people visit at the Berkeley Lab or Brookhaven and so on. I mean, they have all those infrastructure to operate even more effectively.
Yeah. So a couple of things you said I want to respond to. One is I don't like the idea of making it a synchrotron beamline that you would go to, because one of the things about electron microscopes is very unpredictably they go down. Synchrotrons go down.
Line two.
I mean, that's a little detail that reviewers may or may not buy into, but this is it's a point that I don't like. What I want instead, myself anyway, is a mail-in thing, not a travel there and do your experiment.
so that when the sample arrives, it's there. If the microscope's down, that's okay. Once it's up, they schedule it, they schedule you in, and they tell you what time it's going to be on, and if you want to get up at 2 in the morning and so forth to monitor from your emulator, you're welcome to do so. So the way the U.S. funding establishment works is, first of all, you have to convince the rest of the scientific community and the administrators that there is a need for the model and that they should send. Then eventually, when they decide, they issue a call for proposals. And so the National Centers for people can apply. Somebody entirely new can apply. A synchrotron can apply, and so forth. And may the best man win. That's the way it works in the U.S.
So one thing that came out of this NRAM meeting a few years ago is this idea of a Canadian centralized facility, and I think we've done a few things slightly differently. Unfortunately, right now I can't tell you whether we have the money. We'll know, I think, in a couple of weeks. Howard could.
It's coming soon, yeah.
We'll find out very soon. But we got a group of people together before we built the facility, and the initial reaction is, yes, we want a centralized facility, and I want it to be in my backyard. but we realized that wasn't going to work, so we sat down together and decided where the best place was, and people realized that it wouldn't necessarily be in their backyard. And I'm trying to remember what the other key points are. I think the main feature is that you get the group together before you decide to build something, so that everyone is equally invested in the project. They decide that it won't be their personal microscope, and then you can really build a multi-user facility.
So Europe has, in Leiden, set up a facility from FEI, and Sergio De Carlo is there. Maybe we should have.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that. Actually, here I'm not speaking on behalf of FEI, but on behalf of the state.
There is an international facility that has been opened in October 2011. It took a while to set it up and have everything ready, but there are two Titan cryos. If you are interested in the configuration, you can look. If you don't care about the poster from FEI, you can just look above or on the table outside on the FEI. There are a few brochures, and you can have more information, or you can ask me. So there are two Titan cryos, and the good news is that the Dutch equivalent of the National Science Foundation has decided to open the facility worldwide at the peer-reviewed rate. So people who have money and want to access the cryos but don't have a cryos can access it for 3,000 euro, which is about 4,500 US dollars for 24 hours of data collection with an operator included. And the idea is that an external scientific committee will be set up very soon so that people can send in a 3 pages, maybe 5 pages, the details are not known to me yet, but a short proposal that shows feasibility that the project is fit for a cryos, and then you will have access for 750 euros per 24 hours, which is, I think, if my brain is not fried, less than $40 per hour. So I think it's really cheap. And so you have two Titan cryos. One is set for tomography with a direct electron detector from FEI, an FEI Falcon first generation, and a quantum GIF from Gatan. The other one is the microscope that Holger has in Göttingen. Is an XFEG CS corrector, second generation Falcon. So it's more suitable for single particle project.
I can sort of tell you my experience with the Genalia Farm Cryos instrument. Sort of a compromise of my backyard versus mailing in. So a lot of people are sort of hesitant to send their sample, you know, to this unknown facility. Like the first time that we used it, we went there, you know, sort of got the feel for the place. And now what we've been doing is sending our samples, you know, in a dry shipper. There, so we kind of have it's sort of the best of both worlds. You know, you don't have to really spend a heck of a lot of money to travel anymore. You You're just sending your samples there, and you can kind of, they have a remote sort of viewing, semi-operating setup that you can, you know, tell them which particles you want, what's thing, how things are going, and then interact with it. So that's kind of a you know, sort of the best of both worlds. It may be a good model to use in the future.
Yeah, I thought it'd be good to say something just about the parallel between the X-ray synchrotron community and what looks like we will have to do, because it's just so expensive. You know, if you're spending $5 or $10 million, then to justify that expenditure, a lot of people have to use it, and a lot of papers have to be published. Otherwise, if you take the business model from companies, it's just non-viable. You know, it's just nobody would fund it. So what happened with the synchrotrons was exactly that. People were investing in in-house sources, and then a few people went to the synchrotrons, and it was a bit iffy. You would go there, it would be down, and so on. But gradually, with time, it got better. And so now, they almost all of them run, you know, 95% success rate. They're hardly ever down. People don't go there anymore. They sit at home in their lab, and they're doing it, and they can see the robot. They can see the data sets. They can dismount crystals. And they send in 500 crystals, something like that, in a Dewar, which is transferred. So, but I think, at the moment, we're not at that level of automation or reliability or anything like that. In fact, these new cameras are barely available. You know, it's the people who have them are just getting the first results. So I think, you know, it's some years off, but still.
But we have to plan now because it will take 4 or 5 years in the U.S. Yeah.
So so Helen Sable was the one in the U.K. who has decided to follow the synchrotron model. And as someone mentioned, because they're already set up, they have a lot of infrastructure. You can go there if you want, but they've got each beam line, there's about 30 of them, or 23 running, and another 7 or 8 planned, a diamond. Each of them have 3 or 4 beam line scientists who run it 24 hours a day, make sure it works. And that turns out, once you're investing, each beamline is about 10 million, it's about the same as the microscope. That's a viable thing. So I think now is the time, indeed, as Bob says, we have to plan for that. But there's an awful lot of details, reliability, robots, and exactly what equipment you buy. You know, you can't replace it every 18 months or 2 years. So what's happened with the synchrotrons, I think it's the dust settled, and now people know how to build synchrotrons and keep them running. So I think we should make the plan, but not rush into it too quickly.
Yeah.
I just want to address the concern about downtime.
Yeah.
I think to be realistic, such a center really needs a whole battery of microscopes.
Uh-huh.
So it becomes sort of a random event.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Beijing, for instance, I think six Titans are going to be put there in a row.
It's a wonderful suggestion because it would solve the problem, and I hope peer reviewers and the NIH administrators would go for it, but I'm worried that they won't. And so, multiple microscopes at a facility might be a later phase when there really is a lot of demand. Be my guess.
Can we outsource the access for people that aren't microscopists? You know, people that have samples, say, and that you know, want really good structures. They're much more interested in the biology. I mean, you know, right now, if you want, you know, even to go to our center, right, you should know something about electron microscopy, and you should be able to get the structure.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, but how do we open up to a larger group? I guess.
I think the center that runs this either has to have the expertise as you do here. Or the other scientist has to find a collaborator who is an expert in EM, because it really comes down to it's more a question of processing the data and getting a valid result than actually collecting the images.
I have a comment. So while the leaders are trying to figure out the future plan for which model to use, while we are waiting for the U.S. economy to get better, I don't want you to do some advertisement here. So as you all know that I run a facility at UCLA, and we have two Titan instruments. One is the Titan STEM and Titan Krios. It is fully open to everybody. But if those of you who don't have access to those instruments, there's a recharge which is online. I mean, those are available. So if you want to address your immediate needs while you're waiting for the long-term solution, you're welcome to go to UCLA. You can mail that too. We have Legion set up. You can use that remotely, all that. So just let me know if you want to use those instruments. Okay, thank you. The question is, what is the cost? The cost is actually listed online. So for the Titan, Titan Krios is the most expensive. It's $2,000 per day, 24 hours, if you run 24 hours. And the Titan STEM, which is cheaper, is $1,200 per 24 hour session. But if you do it early, it will be more expensive. Yeah, so those are dictated by the UCLA administration. It has nothing to do with me.
So from my point of view, I think I can't remember any single case where I have heard that somebody had a good protein and went to a highly equipped lab also in the past and asked, can I use your microscopes? And the lab said no. I mean, as a student, as a PhD student, I spent many weeks in Werner Kühlmann's lab in the basement, and once I went to Martin's Reed, and I was in Ken Downing's lab using the microscopes when ours broke down. Yeah, so the practice is, I think, that big facilities are open anyway.
That's not true. I mean, the amount of time it takes to collect data, we have to turn people away. I mean, you know, we have to get our own work done, and we have many more requests than we can fulfill. And I'm guessing that's true for WAR too. I mean, it just isn't the hours on the instrument. I absolutely agree that we need centralized facilities so people can just go in and have it through WAR. It's just so many more people doing choir now than there were when you were a student.
Yeah.
Have respect for that comment.
So then there are difficult projects and easy projects, and some projects require a lot of time on the wet bench and trying to get the sample pure, and then if it's a high profile target, you want to go to the microscope early when it's not yet perfectly pure, then you're emotionally attached, and I wonder if you, when you send your protein to a facility, the operator there is as attached to that sample as you are and is willing to spend on a dirty prep hours and hours trying to find the needle in the haystack. So I think we need a mix. We need a mix of service facilities. I agree with that. I think we have well-equipped labs that have open doors. Yeah? And then we need also smaller instruments in the basements. For this one, in the basements of individual biology labs, for this one I have my doubts if the manufacturers would be interested in that, because I think a lot of the cost for the microscopes that we pay is development costs, and then producing a few more of these machines isn't that expensive. Yeah, how much does it actually cost to build a Titan now since they figured out how to do it? Yeah, 100,000, 200,000, and we pay a few million?
They haven't figured out how to do it.
So this was the Morgani model, right? We would need another Morgani now, high-end Morgani.
One disconnect that Bridget pointed out is that a microscope like a Titan is actually designed as a screening microscope where you look through and try to find the good grid with your autoloader. And it doesn't make any sense to screen your specimens on the most expensive microscope available. So I think any model would have to have screening on a low-end microscope and only data collection on the most expensive microscopes.
One time I talked to the head guy of FEI, which was a meeting here in the U.S. somewhere, I think NIH, 3 or 4 years ago, and he said the next generation will be exactly that. It'll be, you know, sort of low tech, you know, easy to use, widely spread technology. And I don't know whether that is still the business model, but it's exactly what this reminds me of.
Maybe Dave, you're
on
the advisory board?
No pressure.
You know, I think so did they talk about that, or
not that I've heard with any finite plans.
His non-disclosure agreement doesn't allow him to answer that question.
Sorry.
Well, I'm sure. I think there's one item missing from the new generation of portable microscope, and that is very reliable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's,
same as a Joel. It's a big 200 kilo.
The Joel, yeah.
Question here?
So if there were centers like Genelia Farms, how would that influence what the manufacturers would be willing to build with the CS correctors and cameras and ever more expensive microscopes?
It would have a chilling effect, I imagine. But I think they may be running out of customers because that's what we're discussing, that people can't. There's a certain number of people who have them or are about to get them, et cetera, but is that going to continue forever, or is that market going to dry up?
Could you make an argument that with a center, they'd be willing to pay a good deal more, which includes a bigger chunk of the development costs?
Yeah, so center would have a chilling effect. The next generation affordable would have the detectors and would continue to sell products for... It's not my business to work out, you know, what the cost and the business model and profit, et cetera. The manufacturer has to work that out, or they won't do it.
Well, so what we've been seeing is that the governments have been putting money into development, whether it's the spotted on or these new direct detectors, that it's been government grants and government subsidies that have been doing the actual development. Yeah. And you know, Gitan and FEI and all these companies are now, they essentially didn't pay those costs, but are kind of getting the benefits of these, of making these and selling these.
I wouldn't trivialize the amount of money and effort that these companies have put into these cameras by any means whatsoever. They may have had help in design and encouragement and support in early steps, but making commercial products is a big challenge. Companies are really to be, I think as Richard pointed out, that we should thank them very much for their efforts and that we should buy these cameras to keep the process going.
Hi, John Marone, Cornell University. I'm on the executive committee for the Cornell Nanofabrication Facility. And I think that these national nanofabrication facilities are pretty good role models for you guys. There, the high-end instrumentation is the electron beam lithography system, for which they can charge the academic user $200 an hour, and for the outside user, $700 an hour. So your folks will drive from Corning to use this thing to pattern 20 angstrom features, and they'll pay, $700 an hour for this thing. And through the industrial money, you can, offset a lot of the cost for the academic users. People will fly from all over the world. They fly from Europe to use it. The facility cranks through 300 new users per year with 18 staff. The training time just to get in the door for safety is 2 days. The average person works there, I'm going to guess, weeks. The external user, you to get projects started, you can hire staff to do some screening for you to see if processes will work, to see if you want to plunk down your change and travel time to do something. So there's a range of models that can be used to bring people in through staff getting things started to you just flying there. And the money comes from the NSF and from also Cornell. And the Joel Company, for example, bends over backwards to sell us stuff because they feel if all these users use the Joel lithography system, then they have an easier time going home and selling this high-priced item to their own department because they can demonstrate that it works at this big national facility where the staff are there babysitting it and make sure that it actually works and is up. So in summary, I would say that this community should look hard at the National Nanofabrication Facilities as a decent role model for this. Because the service contracts are really quite comparable, I think.
Nico has a question over here.
I just thought I want to come back to the second possibility. And my impression was with the new detectors, we don't need high-end instrumentation anymore. Well, it's a little provocative, of course, but the need for the highest end instruments will probably lessen a little.
I think some components will be needed, yeah. Like you, especially with the detector, you want the highest voltage.
Absolutely,
you can get.
But is it still going to be the?
You don't probably need a super good stage.
Yes. Is it? I mean, we were quite happy until the Titan Cryosis came along.
Yeah.
With having those the previous version mics, maybe even before the Polara. Those were affordable, and I wonder if microscopes at that level could be, or for that kind of cost, could be built at, with the new detectors that would then be suitable for.
Yeah, I'm with you. I would think it would be possible. Yeah.
So I have two quick announcements.
Yeah.
So at 5 o'clock is the manufacturer's exhibit, so they're standing by to take your orders. So FBI is here, Gatan is here, Prototypes has a table, and Direct Electron is here as well. So we did have a number of manufacturers provide financial support for the meeting. So if you're not going to do your order tonight, at least go by and thank them for their support for the meeting. And then also the posters should come down from the A to L's, and the next one's going to